It is Monday, November the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, potential political change in Israel.
There are a whole number of new parties, some center-right, some far-right, as well as growth in new religious parties.
We'll have the latest on the killing of a Saudi journalist.
This could have been a rogue operation. That being said, you know, it would certainly be unusual.
The California wildfires plus the 40th anniversary of the Jonestown Massacre. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Sunday he would take on the defense minister portfolio, rejecting calls to dissolve his government even as early elections appeared increasingly likely. Mr. Netanyahu said heading to the elections now amid repeated violent confrontations with Gaza militants would be, in his words, irresponsible of his coalition partners who have been pushing for early polls since the resignation last week of Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman over a Gaza ceasefire. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with University of San Francisco Middle East scholar Stephen Zunis, who says early elections are a definite possibility.
The Religious Nationalist Jewish Home Party has announced it's also likely to pull out, which would bring them down to 53 seats. There are some interesting dynamics at work. You had the defense minister, Lieberman, engaging in this risky operation in Gaza while the prime minister was in Europe for the commemorations of World War I. It was a botched operation. They ended up both killing the Israeli operatives and some top Hamas officials. And Hamas, of course, retaliated with the rocket attacks and heavy bombing and threatened to escalate. Netanyahu put a stop to it. And Lieberman's upset because he, frankly, wanted to go to another full-scale war. And so it's a bit odd to see that Netanyahu is in trouble for being too moderate on such matters. But this is the most right-wing coalition Israel has seen. At the same time, it may be to Netanyahu's advantage to move ahead with elections. There are those who believe that may, in fact, be his wish, because there have been corruption scandals that are growing around him. He has not been directly implicated yet. One involved the government buying submarines and other vessels. The Navy didn't particularly want or need. They had higher priorities. Ends up there's a lot of bribery going on. But there are three other corruption investigations, which some suspect may implicate Netanyahu himself. Which might be a reason he'd want to have the elections out of the way sooner than later.
He's been in power now for four terms. Is the public getting weary of Mr. Netanyahu?
His popularity is definitely declining. Concerns, of course, about the corruption and just the fact that he's been in power so long. But, of course, there are also the longstanding critics on the left who believe his continued policy of settlement expansion and the periodic armed conflicts with Hamas has not made Israel more secure, that essentially refusing to move ahead with a viable two-state solution that is feared is going to just encourage radicalism. But at the same time, the demographics and other changes in Israel have brought more and more Israelis into the right-wing nationalist camp. So it's hard to predict what kind of outcome would occur in the event of an early election.
What is this going to do to the nascent Israel-Palestinian peace process, with the Trump administration expected to roll out its new peace proposal?
Well, the peace proposal has been delayed for some time, though I don't think anybody takes it real seriously in the sense that the main people involved in putting this thing together, Trump's ambassador to Israel, Adam Friedman, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and others, tend to ally with some of the more right-wing elements in Israel that actually support the expansion of Israeli settlements and control of Palestinian areas occupied since 1967. and similarly oppose the establishment of a viable Palestinian state. So it's hard to imagine, given the failure of peace proposals by more moderate governments to create a workable settlement, that anything the Trump administration puts forward will be taken seriously.
Do you see anyone politically viable who could succeed Mr. Netanyahu? I haven't heard of very many names.
Neither have I. The Israeli political scene is in a very different place than it was some years ago, back when it was a broad left-wing, left-leaning coalition headed by the Labor Alignment and the right-wing coalition headed by Likud. There are a whole number of new parties, some center-right, some far-right, that and as well as a growth in new religious parties representing various factions. It's really hard to tell who's who nowadays, and I see no clear front-runner emerging.
Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco is an international relations scholar specializing in Middle East politics, U.S. foreign policy, and strategic nonviolent action. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump says there is no reason for him to listen to a recording of the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, which was put him in a diplomatic bind of how to admonish Riyadh for the slaying, yet maintain strong ties with that ally. For some insight into the October killing of Khashoggi and whether the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was responsible, as some, including apparently unnamed U.S. intelligence sources, have contended, VOA's Lori London spoke with Jameel Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute and adjunct professor of law at George Mason University.
What we've heard thus far is, sort of rumors coming out of the intelligence community that the CIA has reached this conclusion. The president said this week, if we take him at his word, this weekend, that the CIA is going to deliver to him a report this week, and he'll review that. He said he hasn't had a chance to review it as yet. So I think that what he's been saying is that a lot of people are saying that the Crown Prince didn't do it, and the Crown Prince has told him that he wasn't involved in it, and that a lot of people around the Crown Prince are saying that he wasn't aware of it. And then of course the Saudis have taken some significant action this past week with the public prosecutor indicting a number of individuals. I think 17 were being held, 11 were indicted. I think they're seeking the death penalty for something like 5 of those, a significant action taken by the public prosecutor, and in addition, an evolving story coming out of that. Now, sort of the claim being that he was that there was a team sent to bring him back, either through negotiations or directly, without his consent. Then he was drugged, and then the drug that the overdose caused him to pass away. There was a fight, apparently, also. So, the story has evolved significantly over time. But we have seen the Saudis take action here, and so, the question of what the CIA is actually going to say in this report, I think we still have to, get ground truth on. We don't have that quite yet. We've heard stories coming out of the CIA. There's no reason to not believe those aren't credible, but again, the president says he hasn't gotten the report yet.
But if, in fact, it's true that the Saudi Crown Prince did order these people to go do this, which, from all indications, from my understanding, is that nothing as involved as this with these this many people going on planes, flying over, and conducting an act like this wouldn't have been done without them being directly ordered to do that in this type of regime. So wouldn't it seem sort of, you know, you're looking at these people that are being arrested and some of them being given the death penalty, that they're by the very person that may have ordered them to do the killing?
Certainly that is obviously concerning. If, in fact, there is evidence that the Crown Prince ordered the killings, or the killing, I should say, ordered the team to go and engage in these activities, that's obviously a huge issue. You know, what we know publicly is that he and the people around him have denied it in no uncertain terms, and that they've taken action, very aggressive action, you know, seeking the death penalty against some of these folks, against those who are claimed to have been leading it. Now, it is true that in a regime like this, that's controlled at the top by the king and then obviously day-to-day by the Crown Prince, it would be highly unusual for sort of a rogue operation to take place, particularly of this scope and magnitude and of this sort of importance and likely to have these kind of consequences. That being said, in dictatorships and monarchies, coups do happen, palace coups internal to them without the senior leadership knowing. And so, it's not crazy to think that this could have been a rogue operation. That being said, it would certainly be unusual.
Jamil Jaffer is an adjunct professor of law at George Mason University. He was speaking with VOA's Lori London. Well, as you may have heard, there have been days and days of massive wildfires in both the southern and northern regions of the U.S. state of California. President Trump visited the state over the weekend and promised federal government help. Meantime, the state's governor, Jerry Brown, has suggested California's wildfires will make the most ardent of climate change skeptics believers in the coming years. At least 76 people have died so far. More than 1,000 people are still missing. Thousands of homes have been destroyed. Jay Lawrence, a national spokesperson for the Red Cross, is in the town of Paradise. That's in Northern California, which has been virtually incinerated.
It's heartbreaking. You drive down the street and you see houses that are just ash, with only the chimney standing. Maybe there's some foundation. You know, there's a car burned out in the driveway. And then you see there's a church that's still standing.
Wow.
You see a crumpled restaurant. You see a power pole burned up to the cross trees from the ground. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. And then there are two houses made of wood that are apparently okay. So it's unbelievably heartbreaking and devastating. There were thousands of houses that were destroyed in this fire, and the people are going to have to continue to cope with the aftermath.
And in Southern California, at least three people have died, with almost all of the coastal community of Malibu leveled. The fire in the south is about 80% contained now, maybe a bit more, and in the north, it is roughly 60% contained. Sunday marked the 40th anniversary of the massacre of hundreds of cult followers of the San Francisco-based People's Temple of the Reverend Jim Jones in a remote enclave in the former South American British colony of Guyana. Among the dead was U.S. Congressman Leo Ryan, who went to investigate what was happening to loved ones of the many his constituents were worried about. Congressional aide, now Congresswoman Jackie Speier, accompanied Ryan and was wounded there. She is adamant today that what happened was not a mass suicide, but a mass murder. Jones demanded more than 900 followers, including children, drink a powdered drink mix laced with cyanide. Julia Shears is a journalist and author who wrote the book A Thousand Lives about Jonestown. She speaks with my colleague, Victor Beatty, and says she agrees that this was a horrific case of mass murder.
Jim Jones wanted the world to believe that people willingly lined up and drank this poison punch, but it's a mythology. They were killed. So Jackie Speier and I are on the same page as far as that is concerned.
We're talking about 914 adults and children. How did this come about?
Think of 1978 Guyana, middle of the jungle. They were completely cut off from the outside world. Jim Jones led them to believe that if they did not like this utopian society that they were going to create, that they could come back to California. However, when they got to Jonestown, which was a two-day river journey, he took away their passports, he took away their money, and he told them that if they wanted to go home, they could swim home. From there, things just got worse. There was only one ham radio for communication with the outside, and no one was allowed to use it except for Jim Jones and his inner circle. All of the mail coming into and out of the compound was censored. There was no way, once he had them trapped down there, for the people of Jonestown to let the world know what was really happening.
How could people on such a mass scale be mesmerized by one man?
Like anyone who goes to church, I grew up in the church. And when you belong to a church, it's about so much more than the minister. It's about the sense of a common goal. In People's Temple's case, you know, they had some very noble beliefs. They believed in trying to create a better society where there would be no sexism or racism or elitism. That's what Jonestown was supposed to be, this model utopian society. So they get down there hoping to participate in this bold social experiment. And then they found out that Jim Jones suddenly is talking about this idea of his called revolutionary suicide. And it's in Jonestown for the first time where he starts to take votes on who is willing to die for socialism. He didn't talk about that back in the United States. He only raised that prospect of quote-unquote revolutionary suicide when he had them all trapped in Jonestown.
Couldn't they have seen trouble coming? Did any of them break away before they made the move to Guyana?
Some people left the church before the move to Guyana, but it was really hard to extricate yourself because they lived in communes. They had to forfeit all of their money to the church. If they left, they would be cut off from their loved ones who are still in the organization. He made it very difficult for people to leave.
Julia Shears also told VOA's Victor Beatty she doesn't think such a massacre could occur today, finding it difficult to imagine in an era of cell phones and satellite phones and social media so many people would be cut off from the outside world. And she also believes, for better or worse, people today are more skeptical and cynical. Her simple takeaway is, trust your conscience if you see or hear things that don't seem right. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
What makes a kilogram a kilogram? Since the late 18th century, the standard which a kilogram has been measured has been based on Le Grand K, a chunk of platinum alloy held at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures Laboratory at Sèvres, France. But now a group of delegates representing 60 countries at the 26th General Conference of Weights and Measures have voted to redefine four of the international system of units: the kilogram, the ampere, Kelvin temperature, and the amount of substance known as the mole. Scientists say they use the constants and equations of quantum mechanics to determine the new measurement standards. Rather than base these measurements on archaic standards, they will be defined by natural phenomena, which scientists say will be a million times more stable than artifacts such as Le Grand K. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It's time now for a little something from the world of music. Baker is an American singer-songwriter. Starting her career in the late 1970s with the funk band Chapter 8, Baker released her first solo album in 1983. And in 1986, she rose to stardom following the release of her platinum-selling second album, which included the Grammy-winning single, Sweet Love. Baker is regarded as one of the most popular singers of soulful romantic ballads during the height of the so-called quiet storm of contemporary R&B in the 1980s. In 1989, her song, Giving You the Best That I Got, won Best R&B Song, and Baker got the nod for Best R&B Vocal Performance. Baker has won 8 Grammy Awards and has 5 platinum albums and 1 gold album. Her vocal range is contralto, and what an amazing voice it is. I mentioned her second album earlier. Rapture was initially slow in sales, but when it took off, it really skyrocketed with the hit song Caught Up in the Rapture. Baker was born in 1958 in Toledo, Ohio. When she was two, her mother abandoned her, and Baker was raised by a foster family in Detroit, Michigan. By the time she was 16, Baker began singing R&B at Detroit nightclubs. And in 1988, she married Walter Bridgeforth Jr. They were divorced by 2007, and they have two sons. Anita Baker currently lives in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, and continues to tour more than 300 days a year worldwide with that soulful voice. What's easy is to get caught up in the rapture, that amazing voice of Anita Baker's. Love it so. Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We all hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Anita Baker.
This is Today in History. On November 19, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln delivered one of the most famous speeches in American history at the dedication of the Military Cemetery at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Lincoln's 10 sentences received little attention at first, but northern newspapers took note of their powerful message in which he articulated the meaning of the U.S. Civil War. On this day in 1887, fictional detective Sherlock Holmes made his debut in A Study in Scarlet, a story written by British physician Conan Doyle. Specializing in solving unusual cases using his extraordinary powers of observation and logical reasoning, Sherlock Holmes would appear in four novels and 56 short stories. On this day in 1942, the Soviet Red Army launched a huge counteroffensive against German troops that turned the tide in the Battle of Stalingrad and eventually in the war between Germany and the Soviet Union. And on this day in 1961, record industry history was made when Chubby Checker's original hit song, The Twist, re-entered the charts on its way to becoming the first record to reach number one for a second time. The Twist reached the top position in 1960, but Checker's appearance on the popular Ed Sullivan Show pushed it back onto the charts. Chubby Checker was born Ernest Evans, but the wife of TV host Dick Clark suggested the name Chubby Checker as a takeoff on then-popular singer Fats Domino. The name stuck, and Chubby Checker and his dance craze, The Twist, became a part of music history. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.